This is Peter Johnson introducing the Catholic Heritage Program, broadcasting from England, bringing you traditions, trips, and information from our Catholic past and inspiration for our Catholic future. One of the greatest cathedrals in England is to be found at Durham in the northeast. Numerous saints are associated with Durham, including St. Anne, St. Baldred, St. Bartholomew of Farn, St. Bede the Venerable, St. Bilfrith, St. Boisil, St. Cuthbert, St. Edfrith, and certainly not the least of them, St. Oswald. Here is Tim Matthews, who has recently visited Durham.
One day, early in 1770, Henry, the 8th Lord Arundel, wandering round his estates in Wiltshire in south-east England, ordered a farm labourer, Noel Lever, to stop ploughing over a cornfield. He said that this was exactly the spot where he wanted to build his new house. From the cornfield, he could see, a mile away, the ruins of old Wardour Castle. Lord Arundel's new Wardour Castle was to be completed 6 years later. In 1770, old Wardour, a manor noted in Domesday Book, had been the home of Lord Arundel's family for some 200 years. It had been acquired by them in 1547, specifically by Sir Thomas Arundel, who never made any secret of the fact that he was a Catholic. In fact, 3 years before his execution, he had been in prison for his alleged complicity in the Catholic rising in the West. And under the protection of the family, Wardour was to become the main mass centre of Western Wiltshire for generations. The Jesuits were closely associated with Wardour, and from the days of Queen Elizabeth I to the suppression of their society in 1773, they served faithfully at Wardour. In the Civil War, old Wardour Castle was twice besieged, the first time by parliamentary troops in 1643, when Lady Blanche Arundel had at her disposal 25 fighting men against 1,300 parliamentarians. With her daughter-in-law, Cecily, she stood behind her men supplying them with ammunition, urging them to reply to each shot with a volley. Each day the siege began with mass. But supplies eventually ran out, and after 5 days the castle was surrendered. The second siege followed when Lord Arundel attempted to gain back control of his house. It was a rather dramatic event. Because of a lack of any forces to properly support his attack, he was in the end driven to blow up his own home. The historian Aubrey tells us, "Wardour Castle was very strongly built of freestone. I never saw it but when I was a youth, the day after part of it was blown up. And the mortar was so good that one of the little towers reclining on one side did hang together and did not fall in pieces." It was called Wardour Castle from the conserving there of ammunition of the West. Many of the old yews and hollies in the grounds were formerly cut into the forms of soldiers on guard. For some 100 years following the demolition of old Wardour, the family lived partly in some adapted outbuildings, partly in a house in the nearby town of Fordingbridge. Gradually, however, through some helpful marriages, the family managed to regain its fortunes, and so it was by 1770 that the 8th Lord Arundel felt that he was able to afford to build his new home, sufficiently large to enclose in one wing a chapel, large enough to support the needs of a Catholic population by then recognised to be the largest outside London. Lord Arundel chose for his architect James Payne. Payne was a great admirer of Palladio, and the result of his work at Wardour is thought by some to be one of the best examples of an 18th-century building in England, particularly its staircase. But while Payne was given a free hand in designing the house, Lord Arundel became extremely involved in planning the chapel, and he brought in another architect, Giacomo Quarengi. The fine new chapel was finally opened on the Feast of All Saints, 1776, with the most imposing ceremony presided over by Bishop Walmsley, then Vicar Apostolic of the Western District, the post-Reformation Catholic diocese not yet having been established in England. Then in 1778, A rising young architect, John Soane, visited Wardour, and Lord Arundel commissioned him to enlarge the sanctuary of the chapel. Sir John Soane's designs were completed by March 1790, and the chapel was so grand that it could be better be described as a basilica. In 1790, a one-time Jesuit who had been a chaplain at Wardour visited the Arundels from the United States of America. He was John Carroll, who was in England to be consecrated Bishop of Baltimore by a bishop in London. On his return to Maryland, he kept up a constant correspondence with Lord Arundel. At the outbreak of the French Revolution, Lord Arundel gave temporary refuge to a French bishop, Bishop de la Marche of Saint-Paul de Lyon, assisted émigré French priests, and also helped found the first but short-lived charterhouse in England since the Reformation. A small community of Carthusian monks was settled by Lord Arundel at nearby Coombe after they had been driven out of their own house at Bourbon in Normandy. An inscription in the parish church at Donhead St. Mary records the death of their prior. The Arundels continued to live at Wardour to within living memory. In May 1940, the 16th Lord Arundel and Count of the Holy Roman Empire was taken a prisoner of war and sent to the infamous German prison camp at Colditz. There his health broke down, and in September 1944 he was repatriated. But on his way back to Wardour, he died in a military hospital at Chester. He's buried at Wardour. After the war, the property was dispersed. In 1898, the church had been made over to a trust, and in 1963, this trust mounted a restoration appeal for the restoration of the by-then-decaying church. Under the direction of the Soane Museum in London, the work has been wonderfully successful, a testament to the Catholic faith of those who built it. The ruins of Old Wardour Castle are in the care of English Heritage, and they're open daily, April to October, from 10 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock in the evening, or dusk in October. From November to March, the castle is open from Wednesday to Sunday, 10 to 4, but it's closed in winter at lunchtime, 1 to 2. At New Wardour, Mass is said in the chapel every Sunday at 10:30. This is Tim Matthews for the EWTN Global Network, reporting from the United Kingdom.
Tim Matthews tells us of a little-known Catholic heritage centre in southwest England, Wardour Castle.
John Leyland, who lived from 1502 to 1552, wrote a description of this city which is pretty accurate to this day. The close itself of the minster on the highest part of the hill is well walled and hath diverse fair gates. The church itself and the cloister be very strong and fair. The castle standeth on the northeast side of the minster, and Weir runneth under it. The keep standeth aloft and is stately built. The buildings of Durham town are meekly strong, but neither high nor costly. There appear some pieces of walls of the town joining to a gate of the palace wall, but the town itself within the peninsula is but a small thing in respect of the circumference of all the stately close, so this alone may be called the walled town of Durham. The Diocese of Durham is the lineal descendant of the Anglo-Saxon see of Lindisfarne, which was founded by St. Aidan in 635, when he came from the monastery of Iona at the request of St. Oswald, King of Northumbria, to evangelize that newly conquered heathen kingdom. He built his monastery on the island of Lindisfarne, now Holy Island off the Northumbria coast, and this meant that Northumbrian Christianity was of Celtic origin and followed the Celtic use as to the observance of Easter and other matters. But in the south, the Roman use prevailed, and conflict became inevitable. The controversy was finally settled in 664 at Whitby, when the Roman use was adopted. Some 200 years later, in 875, the Bishop of Lindisfarne was driven from his see by the Danes, and taking the body of St. Cuthbert with his monks, he fled. On the depth of St. Cuthbert, his body was wrapped in cerecloth, covering his head, then clothed in vestments, and placed in a stone coffin and buried on the right side of the altar at Lindisfarne. 11 years later, it was found to be uncorrupted. The monks clothed it in a new garment and kept it above ground. So, in 875, when the bishop and monks fled from Lindisfarne, they decided to take with them, in a wooden coffin, St. Cuthbert's body, together with the relics of several other saints, including St. Aidan and St. Oswald. Their journeys took them, eventually, to the town of Chester Street, where they settled in 883. About 100 years later, St. Cuthbert's body was once again on the move, and this time it came to rest at Durham, where for a time it was placed in a wooden church before being transferred in 999 to the so-called White Church. And incidentally, it was here, in the White Church, that we learn that one of the canons, Elfrid, used to care for St. Cuthbert, and, I quote, "wrap him in such robes as he thought fit, adjust his hair with an ivory comb, to cut his nails on his fingers with scissors made for the purpose." But the journeys had not yet ended. In 1069, worried about the movements of William the Conqueror, the monks took St. Cuthbert's body back to Lindisfarne, but only a year before he was back in Durham again, this time in the White Church. When the White Church was pulled down in 1093, a temporary tomb of stone and marble was put up in the cloister garth until the saint's body was translated to its final resting place in the present cathedral in 1104. At that juncture, the coffin was once again examined. Beside the body and relics of the saints, it was found to contain a copy of the Gospel of St. John, which was not replaced but kept in the cathedral until the plunder of the Reformation, and is known to have been in existence in France until at least 1769. St. Cuthbert's coffin, restored, is kept in the chapter library. Set on its cliff-top pinnacle, Durham Cathedral is possibly the finest surviving example of a Norman cathedral in all Europe. The first cathedral here was consecrated in 999 and completed in 1041. The first Norman bishop, Walcher, was murdered by the people in 1080, and he was succeeded by William de St. Caroleff, who began the present cathedral, the foundation stone being laid on the 29th of July, 1093, in the presence of Malcolm, King of Scotland. Bishop Hugh de Pudsey, the king's cousin, was one of the great builder bishops at Durham, and amongst his additions is the Galilee Chapel, a unique specimen of transitional work. And this splendid Galilee has a curious history. It appears that Bishop Hugh de Pudsey, how soon after his elevation to the see we are not told, began building work at the east end of the cathedral. Marble columns and bases were brought from overseas, but the walls had only just begun to rise when great cracks appeared in them. A manifest sign, it was said, that the work was not acceptable to God or to his servant Cuthbert. The cause, no doubt, was the same defective foundation which in the course of the next 100 years produced the subsidence of the choir apse and the impending ruin of its vault. So, abandoning his first intention, Bishop Hugh, no doubt using the materials collected for his eastern chapel, began another work at the west end, into which women might lawfully enter, so that, though they could not be allowed personally to approach the more holy places, they might derive some comfort from the distant contemplation of them. This work was the existing Galilee, so called from a reference to the Galilee of the Gentiles. This was appropriated as a lady chapel, and it remained as Bishop Pudsey left it in 1195 until 1438, when Bishop Langley ordered St. Cuthbert's body to be interred in the Galilee, and a chantry founded in honour of Our Lady. A famous statue of Our Lady of Pity once stood in the Galilee Chapel, while Our Lady of Bolton was another altar dedicated to the Blessed Virgin Mary. Another special feature of Durham is the eastern transept known as the Chapel of Nine Altars, built by Bishop Poore about 1230. One unusual relic at Durham is the sanctuary knocker. It was fixed to the exterior of the north door of the cathedral nave. One ancient account describes it as follows. Near to the altar of Our Lady of Pity, on the south side of the Galilee door, was a grate, whereon the countrymen lay when they fled thither for refuge. In ancient times, before the house was suppressed, the abbey church, the churchyard, and circuit thereof was a sanctuary for all manner of men that committed any great offence, as killing a man in his own defence, or any prisoner who had broken out of prison and fled to the church door, knocking to have it open. Certain men lay in two chambers over the north door for that purpose, that when any such offenders came and knocked, they instantly let them in at any hour of the day or night, and run quickly to the Galilee bell and told it, that whomsoever heard it might know that some had taken sanctuary. When the prior had notice thereof, he sent orders to keep themselves within the sanctuary, that is, within the church and churchyard, and that every one should have a gown of black cloth with a yellow cross, called St. Cuthbert's cross, on the left shoulder, that any one might see the privilege granted to St. Cuthbert's shrine for offenders to fly unto, for succour and safeguard of their lives, until they could obtain their prince's pardon. They had likewise meat, drink, bedding, and other necessaries at the cost of the house for 37 days, until the prior and convent could get them conveyed out of the diocese. There's a list of those who, using the knocker, claimed sanctuary, has been published. The last entry is dated September the 10th, 1524. A Benedictine priory had been established at Durham by Bishop Carilefo, but it was dissolved at the Reformation, and the prior's lodgings became the cathedral deanery. Only the eastern transept, the cloisters, and three towers were built later than the 12th century. The bishop's throne at Durham is said to be the highest in Christendom. In the 14th century, Bishop Hartfield sent observers to the Vatican to measure the height of the Pope's throne, and then had his own built 14 inches higher. Because of its geographical position, the bishops of Durham were led to assume constitutional and political functions in addition to their spiritual office. Consequently, their rights and privileges were extensive, and even to this day the Anglican Bishop of Durham takes precedence over all other English bishops, except those of Canterbury, York, and London. Because of its political importance, the bishopric was not included in the Domesday Book, and even at the time of the Norman Conquest, the county of Durham was governed by the bishop with almost complete local independence. These extreme rights were strengthened by the fact that the bishops frequently had to repel Scottish invasions at their own expense, which fostered both military and financial independence of the Palatinate. The bishops of Durham had within their bishopric every right that the king had in the country. The bishop was therefore head of the civil government, and he appointed all civil officers. Offenders and lawbreakers were tried in the bishop's court, and if necessary, punished by his officials. Forfeiture for treason and forfeitures of war were both in his right, and he could create corporations and erect fairs and markets. He did not, however, have the right of making treaties with foreign powers, but the bishops did have their own mint. So, in theory, the bishop was as a king in his bishopric, and in some instances the king actually infringed upon his rights, and in other cases there was conflict of jurisdiction. One of the last Catholic bishops before the Reformation was Cardinal Wolsey, who already was Archbishop of York. But the very last Catholic bishop of Durham was Cuthbert Tunstall, who lived to see the suppression of the monasteries, the 1536 Pilgrimage of Grace, and 4 years later the surrender of Durham Abbey. With his death on November the 18th, 1559, the line of Catholic bishops ended. 10 years later, during the Rising of the North, the Catholics seized Durham Cathedral, restored the altar, and publicly celebrated Mass, and so it became the last of the old English cathedrals in which Mass was said. Durham suffered badly at the Reformation. The commissioners for the suppression made their appearance in November 1541. The fanatical Calvinist Dean Whittingham dismantle the shrine of St. Cuthbert, and cause the saint's image to be defaced and broken in all pieces, to the intent that there should be no memory nor no. The fanatical Calvinist Dean Whittingham dismantled the shrine of St. Cuthbert, and caused the saint's image to be defaced and broken all in pieces, to the intent that there should be no memory nor token of that holy man. The relics of St. Bede were scattered to the winds, the water stoops were stripped out to be used in a canon's kitchen, and the Neville screen was also ripped out. Our Lady's altar, together with three other altars at which Mass had been offered, were tossed into the backyards of the college. But it was not very long after, orders received perhaps from London, that St. Cuthbert's relics were reburied under the place where his shrine was exalted, behind the high altar, and where a large flagstone marked the interment. In 1827 this site was excavated, and a number of objects were removed to the cathedral library, including a stole and the comb that I spoke of. After the examination, the bones of St. Cuthbert were placed in a new coffin, and these, resting in the old grave on the fragments of the older coffins, were again interred. The Norman castle of the Prince Bishops, set close to the cathedral built by William the Conqueror in 1069, has been used by Durham University since 1832. Many of the population of Durham used to be Catholics, who lived peaceably and disturbed nobody, and nobody them, according to Daniel Defoe in his tour through the whole island of Great Britain of 1722. The Oriental Museum in Durham is the only one in Britain wholly devoted to Oriental art. Millennium City is scheduled to open in Durham in 2001, a cultural and community centre for the city that will include a 500-seat auditorium for concerts, drama, conferences, exhibitions and banquets. You'll find Durham's Tourist Information Centre in the marketplace. This is Tim Matthews for the EWTN Global Network, reporting from the United Kingdom.
We hope that you've enjoyed this look at some of our Catholic heritage. There'll be more next time, so we hope you'll join us then. If you have any comments or snippets of history or information, do write to me, Peter Johnson, at Catholic Heritage, EWTN Global Catholic Radio, 1500 High Road, Vandiver, that's Vandiver, Alabama, USA, 35176. Or you can email us at radio@ewtn.com. Thank you.